Yes, that line forms on the right, babe.
Yeah.
Not that Maggie.
Uh-huh.
Is back in touch.
McMonagle here with you for the next 3 hours as I got you till 5 o'clock and the warm-up show. 888-808-1019. We got Big Zoo on the other side, and we're rolling with you. Me and you, three straight hours, taking your calls at 888-808-1019 on what has been, this is the best baseball morning in New York City that we have had in a month. Sure, the Mets have won some games. They have now won... what is it? Five of their last six, so they're turning it around, and they've been turning around, and they even beat the Yankees a couple days, so the Met fans have certainly been happier since that first game of the doubleheader against Milwaukee. But that win last night for the New York Mets is the kind of win that sparks you. The kind of win that you're down four runs in the eighth inning, and you get off the deck with your superstars doing what superstars do. That's a great win for the New York Mets. A win that felt like earlier in the season. A win that felt like last year, dare I say. A win that felt like a team that's getting ready to get Manaea back, as we just saw him make his quote-unquote, hopefully, last rehab start. You got Senga around the corner. Your bullpen's coming back. And for the first time, you're seeing all three of your top superstar players, Lindor, who hits the enormous, and I think the biggest hit of the game, is that two-run home run that cuts the deficit to two in the eighth inning. That's really what sparks that inning. You get Soto to follow it up with a hit, Soto, and then Pete Alonso, Mr. Clutch himself, who is the complete antithesis of what he was last year. Every big spot, every big hit, he comes through with the two-run bomb, tie game. They win it in extras. We'll get to all the details of it, but a very good, very positive, very satisfying come-from-behind late-game win in a game where your pitcher gets lit up. Clay Holmes has a terrible sixth inning. And you come back and win that game. Yeah, you've won a bunch here, but this is the game that you really feel like that can spark you. That's a good win taken into a lousy series. You're about to lose the first game after coming off the Subway Series, coming off the winning series against Milwaukee. You go into Baltimore, and Clay Holmes, one of your most trusted guys here until Manaea and Senga come back and start pitching well, and he can't get through the sixth, and that's a trend that you're dealing with in the starting rotation. He gives up the single, double, just couldn't get an out there in the sixth inning, and you're concerned about Clay Holmes. You lead that in the sixth inning. Now you're like, man, this team, the pitching still isn't there. I don't know about this bullpen. Clay Holmes now, all the innings, transitioning from a reliever. He's been bad in the second half, even as a closer with the New York Yankees. The inning limits and everything, Mendoza should have pulled him. That's where you're at in that moment, and then this team rallies, and for the first time, you're feeling all three guys get hot at the same time. You're yet to see it. Pete came out of the gate hot immediately. It took about a week and a half for Lindor to match him. They both had pretty good starts, but while Soto was still not himself, not producing like you'd want, then he got hot in June. And Lindor has been in the tank for a month. And Alonso, well, not, I don't know if I'd say that necessarily, but not nearly what he was in the first couple of months. And now, if you can get these three going, as your starting pitching is coming back, as you're seeing Reed Garrett, Brazoben, who gets the save in this game, and that's another thing, with only 10 pitches, surprised Mendoza doesn't bring back out Diaz for the bottom of the 10th. But he's coming around. Greed Garrett's coming around. You know what you have in Diaz. We're already talking about attacking the trade deadline and getting some relievers there. You've got pitchers coming back to the rotation, and now this lineup that still has issues, still has guys like Vientos struggling. Winker back at least makes you feel a little bit better than now he's back in the lineup and gives you a left-handed bat as you send Marte to the IL. Still questions with this team, but pitching coming back, bullpen solidifying itself, winning 5 of 6 games, rallying back with your superstars having clutch hit after clutch hit, including Soto in the 10th. That's a good, positive, successful night to start a series against the Baltimore Orioles. And then we get to the New York Yankees. Now, I'm not going to make too much about the win, necessarily. But Yankee fans, me and you, I know we have a up-and-down relationship, to put it kindly. I'm one of you. And ultimately, we'll always connect on that level. But we go back and forth. We're not happy about everything. We disagree on some things. But I would venture to say that every Yankee fan, Boone hater, Boone defender, the three of us, Cashman hater, Cashman lover, the 10 of us, last night was exactly what every Yankee fan needed deep down in their soul. And it starts with the great news that I woke up to late in the afternoon. I had an interesting morning. No need to get to it. I'm on no sleep. It's going to be great. But I woke up late afternoon to the idea that Aaron Boone and the New York Yankees finally came to their senses. And he told John Boy in his interview that Jazz is back at second base. And then we find out exactly why. And we'll get to it. I want to talk about it. 888-808-1019. I understood why they were doing it. Because then you find out that he's not physically able. DJ LeMahieu is not physically able to play third base. And he is now relegated to a bench role. And while the team, when Jazz came back, they wanted to still see if DJ LeMahieu could play and LeMahieu could hit. They wanted to move Jazz back to third. Again, we talked about the dynamics of the trade deadline. And here's the other thing. Then they go through this really massive offensive slump. And whatever we think about DJ LeMahieu, and I'm not here to sing the praises of DJ LeMahieu, and I'm tickled pink that we're in the situation we're in where he's the bench player. But there's no doubt about it. He is a far better offensive player. He's actually put up some halfway decent numbers over the last 3 weeks. Believe it or not, I'm going to give them to you as we go through the show. He is a far better offensive player than Peraza. So I kind of understood it while they're going through this offensive slump where they're getting nothing production. You can't just go to Peraza, who could quite possibly be the worst offensive player in the entire game of baseball. DJ at least gives you something, and you've got to try and score some runs. But as we watched it, as we all saw it, Jazz was compromised because of a shoulder and just not playing the same kind of level third base that he was playing last year. And DJ LeMahieu was terrible. And as we get into this game last night, off of the news that they're going to finally stop the madness that we have been watching for 3 weeks, because you cannot continue to play a defensive infield that has 2 dead spots in it. When we have Volpe playing the worst defense of his career, you can't have the other 2 be dead spots. It was an atrocious defensive infield, and it was killing them. It had to be done. And to find out they were going to do it, and then immediately the game last night off of an excellent starting pitcher and a team in the Seattle Mariners who came in off of the first time, I believe, in franchise history, 3 straight shutouts. And Gilbert, who we know very well, is a good starting pitcher, a good young starting pitcher. And going up against Warren, who got his doors blown off the last time we saw him in Toronto, to immediately see Will Warren completely pitch with more confidence, throw his fastball, just get an overall really good, solid 5 2/3 of 0-run baseball from Will Warren. And then watch the team awaken. Watch the big home run from Giancarlo Stanton, who you're desperate to get something for. To watch the defensive plays made by Jazz at second base and Peraza at third base. And then you get the Wells three consecutive days with a home run, and the offense explodes against this very good Seattle Mariners team. Will Warren answers the bell, and this was just one of those relaxing, enjoyable, feed-up Yankee experience that the Yankee fans have not had, even in some of the victories, and there's been a few throughout this lousy stretch. This was one off of the news that they finally came to their senses, watching how the team immediately responds to it and plays better defense. Coming off of the great defensive play in the Sunday final game of the Subway Series, where you got Bellinger making the shoestring catch in the double play and feeling like you're trying to, you know, manifest that to be some sort of defining moment of a season, you make finally the smart decision that the entire fan base has been screaming for at least 2-3 weeks of watching Jazz struggle at third and LeMahieu the statue at second base. Immediately, you see the offense wake up. You see someone in Giancarlo Stanton hit a three-run bomb who you are desperate to get going because we know the force he can be. We know all the things that he brings that are detriments, the inability to run. The only position is DH. It clogs up a spot in the lineup for a roster that's kind of constantly in flux because of how many good hitters they have on this team. But you know how dangerous he can be. And to take that high slider from Gilbert and hit it the other way, the way he did, and give the Yankees a four-run lead, and then to watch the offense continue to pound it out the rest of the way, play solid defense, continue to pitch, that was a much-needed cleansing-type victory. Now, they might get their doors blown off tomorrow. I'm not telling you the Yankees are out of it. I'm not telling you I suddenly think the Yankees are back. I've been concerned about this team, and the concerns are still there. Hell, we found out more earlier today as well with the idea that Leiter has a fracture in his leg. So who knows when he's coming back. That's another arm they're missing in the bullpen. They're still in desperate need of bullpen arms. They could probably still use a starting pitcher. They now have a... As much as we all love seeing Peraza at third base and playing good defense and solidifying it for a game, he cannot hit. They need an offensive third baseman who can play the position desperately. There are still needs. There are still concerns. No one is saying the Yankees have. I'm not singing a different tune, but man, did not everything that you needed hit just right last night? That was the exact kind of game just for our psyche, just for our, you know, our baseball sanity. We needed to hear Aaron Boone and the New York Yankees acknowledge what we have known for the last 2 weeks, that it was unsustainable to continue to play a defensive infield the way they were playing it with Jazz and LeMahieu. We needed that to be acknowledged. Even I, the Boone defender and the Cashman defender, I needed that to be acknowledged because it was so blatant and so damaging to the team that instantly, the second I heard it, the second I knew the Yankees were going to make the change, I instantly felt better. I instantly felt better. It was a glass of ginger ale with diarrhea. I instantly felt better. And then to watch it manifest itself in one of the more clean, crisp, solid, dominating wins over a good playoff team and a pitching staff that has dominated. That was as good a win as the Yankees have had in a while. It was as good a win as the Mets have had, despite winning 5 of 6 and turning out of this slump and feeling a lot better and feeling like answers are coming. That's the kind of win you want to see. It was a great night for New York baseball. We needed it desperately. We'll get more into the different aspects of it. Some things I didn't like about Mendoza's, some things I did like about Mendoza. We can get into the different things. Clay Holmes is becoming, I don't know if it's an issue necessarily, but he is what he is and he isn't what he isn't. And I don't know if he's too much more of just a five-inning pitcher. And you can tell he's the kind of guy, we saw it as Yankee fans, the second you know, two hits leads to three to four to five. Like, that's just, he has a tough time, and this is why I was curious about him as a starter in the first place, and he has answered every question I could have possibly had. He's been great. I'm not trying to say otherwise. But my question was, like, we've seen it. When things start rolling out of control as the Yankee closer, he had a tough time putting his foot in the ground and just saying, here, you know, this far but no further. And we saw it a little bit last night in that sixth inning. But the Mets come back, they rally, and their three big players, hot at the same time, come out all with big hits, all with clutch hits, all with game-winning moments and game-winning plays. They take one from Baltimore 7-6 to really kind of reinforce the idea they're out of their slump, and the New York Yankees, at least for one night, acted sane, gave us what we needed, had a crisp, clean, well-played game. And it feels like, hopefully, now that they've won two in a row, with five more games in this homestand before the All-Star break, with hopefully Luis Gil coming back, he begins his rehab assignment this week, the trade deadline coming up, and at least the acknowledgement of they can't continue to play this way. That was an excellent night of New York City baseball, and we haven't had it in a while. 888-808-1019. McMonagle here with you on the Fan. You know what? We'll take a call here in the open. Let's go to Philip in Middletown. What's up, Phil?
Hey, what's up, Chris?
What's up, buddy?
Real quick point, then I'll hang up and listen. My point, like, the last 3 years, right, this Yankee season has been the same. They go into a June or July slump. They get kind of hot before the All-Star break. Then they go into a bad, right after the All-Star break, they start to stink again. Then they get to the trade deadline, they make a couple moves, they get hot. Then they get to the playoffs. 9 times out of 10, they get into the playoffs. And then once the playoffs happen, we see what they do great, right? So I hate the panic all the time. It's a long season. Blue Jays.
Oh, you just made a left turn on me. Thank you very much. I thought you were going the complete opposite way. I like it, Philip.
But what I'm saying is, Blue Jays fans at the beginning of the year were probably panicking about their team. Now the Blue Jays are hot.
Mm-hmm.
So the Blue Jays fans are loving it. But who knows what's going to happen in the next 3 months?
No,
right?
Of course.
So,
roller coaster, and thank you very much for the call, Phil. The roller coaster of the baseball season is treated by many fans in a way that it's unsustainable. Like, you can't, and that's why I'm having fun tonight, because we just needed this. This is not me crowing about the Yankees are back, because to your point, I would be foolish. Like, they're still in a funk here. They have not played well for a long stretch. I'm not going to declare one win as snapping out of it, as nice as it was last night, and as many good signs as we saw in the game. I'm going to give it time, but it felt like a cleansing moment. I think the acknowledgement of moving Jazz off third base and back to second, and then watching him make a play that we have seen. I think John Boy put out the video. You could watch it. Jazz makes that play easy, and LeMahieu's like ends up on the ground, and it gets past him. Like it's not even worth discussing. And I understood why they did it, because Jazz played a great third base last year. We saw it. I had no problem with attempting it. The idea that they did it didn't bother me. The idea they watched it for a month and continued to do it, that's what bothered me, because it was fairly obvious fairly quickly, but they were going through an offensive struggle, and I understand you don't want to just go to Peraza. They are just going to Peraza. Peraza is now the starting third baseman for the New York Yankees for the next month. He can't hit. I'm not thrilled about that. And there's going to be a night or two nights or a moment in a game where he strikes out in a big spot, and we're all like, oh, my God. And not that DJ LeMahieu is much better, but he's significantly better. But, yeah, you're right. This always happens, and it always makes me laugh. Like, when people say, oh, this is just like last year. They went to the World Series last year. Like, I can't say that enough, because I don't think we understand it. Like, we say it, and we go, no, I know. But, like, there's no acknowledgement of the actual accomplishment of getting to the World Series. I don't get it. Oh, this is just like last year. I hope so. I literally hope so. I hope it's just like last year. They get back to the World Series and are up by a run in the 10th inning of game one. Drop me off right there and see if they can play better. But yeah, no, we go up and down and up and down. There's no doubt. We get too emotional. But to be fair, while Toronto got hot, I mean, they picked up, they were up 6-7 games on Toronto 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks, not even a month ago. They're down 3.5. That's a radical swing. And you can't expect to make the same swing and be back up by 3 or 4 games in 2 weeks. Like, this could be, this is going to be a grind. But there is no doubt. We get too up and down. We get too emotional off of every loss. A 6-game losing streak is proof that they can't win a championship, or they can't do this, or they can't do that. The Yankees are still capable of beating anyone in the American League. I don't care what you say. The Yankees are still capable of beating anyone, certainly in the American League, and even in baseball. How have the Dodgers been playing lately? Dodgers got swept by the Angels not too long ago. They just got swept by the Astros. Like, they're not unbeatable. Glasnow is going to come back and make a start. They're not unbeatable. Who's unbeatable? The Yankees are capable of winning a championship. They need some moves, no doubt, but they are capable. And last night doesn't snap them out of the disaster that's been, but it was just, last night was, for a lot of Yankee fans, I don't know how you don't feel this way, it was just a palate cleanse. It was the kind of night you just needed. You needed a good ass kicking, and you needed the team to recognize, to me, the most glaring, stubborn decision that was hurting the team that I can think of in the Boone era. Let's just call it the Boone era. I know you could point to some. This was the most glaring, obvious, you can't do this. And to wake up to the news, at least for me to wake up to the news, to find out that they finally recognized that, it felt good. And then to watch the game play out in the manner it played out, and the offense of Peraza not mattering. In fact, he drives in the first run of the game, putting the ball in play, and allowing the other team to mess up. And that was the other thing, too. There was a couple of scenarios like that. Peraza puts the ball in play. Seattle can't make the play at second base, and we score a run. A base hit up the middle, man on first. Base hit up the middle with less than 2 outs. J-Rod Rodriguez bobbles it, and Bellinger gets to third base. That's what everybody's been doing us. To just watch all that, it felt good. That's a win the Yankee fans needed. 888-808-1019. McMonagle here with you on The Fan. Quick break. We'll come back, continue to take your baseball calls. We got to get to the Knicks, because I don't know if you saw that press conference and stayed awake through it, but apparently he talked for a while and said some things. So we'll get to the idea of the next head coach of the New York Knicks, Mike Brown, speaking and meeting the public. Of course, no Leon Rose. Of course, no answer from anybody else. But we'll get to that. 888-808-1019. McMonagle here with you on The Fan. I got you for another 2.5 hours to take you to 5 o'clock in the warm-up show. We'll be right back. He uses this as a sample in one of his songs, and that's all I hear when I hear this now. I hear the Eminem sample.
Interesting.
Yeah. I can't.
Not even off of like an OG album, like one of the more recent ones that he dropped?
No, it definitely was after. No, yeah, it's one of the more... Relapse is like 09 now.
Damn.
I know. So I'm like, it's definitely after Eminem Show and Encore. Maybe it's on Encore.
See, that's kind of like my line of demarcation, right? From the old Eminem to like the new Eminem is like that Encore album. But it's nuts to think that came out 20 years ago.
Yeah, no,
right?
It's on Encore. It's on Encore. Crazy on you. That came out 2004.
Wow.
21 years ago.
That album can drink.
Yeah. That's how old we are. That's how old we are. We're getting old.
It's unfortunate, but it's good.
Did you see, I forgot, speaking about how old we are, I forgot to talk about this. The Notre Dame wide receiver class?
No, we have not spoken about
okay,
this.
Okay, yeah. So it's like, literally, I gotta find it. It's like nothing but superstars' sons. It's like Larry Fitzgerald's son, Jerome Bettis' son. It's like all these guys who played while we were growing up. I'll find that during the break. I don't want to go searching through it now, but I'll find it. It's amazing. It's all these names. And you're like, this. Every one of their sons is like on Notre Dame this year. See if you can find the list of Notre Dame. I think I saw that they were all wide receivers, but maybe they're not. but there are a bunch of NFL superstars, and all of their sons are going to Notre Dame.
I was going to say one quick thing in terms of another player that I saw, a former player with a son that is on his way. I'm not sure if he's committed anywhere yet. Actually, he is. I see here a commitment to Clemson here. Brandon Jacobs' son, Braden, is a beast.
Is he
that
a beast?
Dude is. I mean, he's a tank. He's like 18. He's a massive.
His father was a tank. His father with that first run of the NFC Championship game against Green Bay in that 2007-2008 Super Bowl run. Never forget it. Brandon Jacobs was the man. They're at my son's flag football games. They're auctioning off at the 50-50 raffle. One of the prizes you could like try to win is a signed Rodney Hampton jersey. And it's funny because they let like kids read off what the like, so every once in a while, like, and the 50-50 prize is a Rodney Hampton jersey. And like little kids are reading, they have no idea who he is. And they're like, Rodney Hampton is a giant legend. He is the first running back to ever run 5,000 yards, the first running back to run for 1,000 yards in 5 consecutive seasons. Rodney Hampton was a member of the 1990 Super Bowl team. Like it's, yes, Rodney Hampton. How do you not know who he is, kid? Learn up.
You got to love that, right? It is funny or kind of crazy, like, kind of sad
they have
too.
Rodney Hampton is so beyond. They don't even know who Tiki Barber is, let alone Rodney Hampton.
But isn't that crazy, right? Yeah. Because, and maybe this is just happenstance, and we were lucky to be born at the times that we were. I'm a little younger than you, but it's still like when I was growing up, there were parts of sports that were kind of bygone era-ish and like, oh, you only saw them on the black and white and like you read about them.
Yeah.
Now, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s even are kind of like that to a lot of these kids. And to us, that was just right there. That just happened.
The other difference is, and I thought about this once too when I was like with my son, like my father's heroes were Mickey Mantle and like, it's not as easy. They're out there. Don't get me wrong. It's not like his father's heroes where you couldn't find them. But like, you know, Rodney Hampton, if that's my favorite, my age, like it was hard for my father to show me things of his guys. It's very easy for me to go to my son and say, this is Derek Jeter. Here's 6 different documentaries on them. I can show you every single big play he ever had with a little quick thing to YouTube. Like it's not the same. Like my parents, like it wasn't the same. Now everything I loved is so in the TV era as we get older, like the next generations, it's going to be a hell of a lot easier to explain things to them and show them exactly what I'm talking about.
At least that's what we think right now, right? Yeah. Because I look at some of the videos of things from when I was a kid or even a teenager in like the early 2010s. And I'm looking at these videos now and I'm going, what? How were we watching this?
Yeah.
It's really crazy.
No doubt. But
So we got to watch out where technology goes. Maybe we end up leaving all this stuff in the past and it becomes the new tape, you know, when you have tape back in the day. My grandparents had a projector.
Listen, there'll be
like
technology
that,
where they're like, oh my God, Dad, you have to push play? That's ridiculous. You have to Google it? I mean, you don't just like, you know, double tap your eyelid? Like,
there are
who knows?
Buttons on the TV.
Yeah, exactly. I still remember having to get up and change the television for my grandfather.
I still do get up sometimes.
Well, you do to what? What do you mean?
I turn off the TV every once in a while when I'm really, really feeling it.
No, but I'm like he didn't have a remote control on when I was a kid. My grandfather's TV, when I was little, he still didn't even have a remote control for it. He would ask me to get up, and it was still like on a dial. It was like an air conditioning knob, and I would turn it to the next channel for him. He's like, "Put on channel 7." Click, click, click.
We had one of those, and to get really, I mentioned this when I was with Al, I believe, last week, and we were talking about some like bygone type of listening to music ways, and we were talking about record players. And one thing I remember vividly from my grandparents' house. They had an 8-track player, and I've never seen that, and I've never seen it since. One of my favorite things, though, that I ever saw as a kid.
Yeah, the 8-track?
It's so beautiful. I mean, it's clunky. You're not bringing it anywhere.
I don't have too much. I think I've seen them a couple times. I don't even know if I've ever played one, but I've seen them a couple times.
I had the Beatles' Let It Be album, and I played it off of there. That's nice. The first time I ever heard that album.
There you go. Great album. One of my favorite songs. I've Got a Feeling is one of my favorite songs. And Dig a Pony might be one of my favorite John Lennon songs.
It's a good one.
Yeah, no, I love I Dig a Pony. That's what's like, and they're, I don't know, I don't want to get into the Beatles here. We're going off the beaten track. Well, we're talking about time. That's right. Time. 237.
And all the young guys over at Notre Dame, which I actually do have the list of, or maybe not a list, but I got a breakdown of them here. So you were correct. You were 100% right on Larry Fitzgerald's son. He will be there.
Yeah.
Also, Jerome Bettis' son is locked in. He's going to be a freshman, I believe. He is a just straight-up high school recruit. A lot of the other guys are transfers. So I'm not going to give you the names of the children because I can't find those readily, but I will give you the names of the dads.
Right.
So first up, we have Larry Fitzgerald and Jerome Bettis.
Right.
We also have Thomas Davis, of course, the outside linebacker for the Panthers, multiple-time All-Pro. And we have the son of Jermichael Finley, tight end, Green Bay Packers.
Wow.
Jermichael Finley took me a second, so, and then it hit me, and I was like, no way.
So they're all, I know, geez. And they're all Notre Dame.
Yes, sir.
And Keith just sent me a text. They already had Jerome Bettis' son, Plaxico's son, and Ryan Clark's.
Yeah, Ryan Clark's son is a safety, I believe, also, right?
So, I mean, that is, it sounds like the Blue Jays lineup from a couple years ago. But, no, that is one hell of a, Notre Dame is just stacked with former NFL studs. Not even just like former NFL players. We are talking about, like, legitimate big-time names. Larry Fitzgerald, Jerome Bettis, those are Hall of Fame players. Like, that's, Plaxico Burress, while not being a Hall of Fame player, and I'll never, you know, I never forgive him. I don't know if that's a term I would use, but he ruined the greatest Giants season I've ever experienced. That 2018, the year after the Super Bowl, I would venture to say, I know we're getting off the beaten path here, but I would venture to say that in my time of watching New York sports, the best team to not win a championship might very well be the 2008 New York Giants. They were dominant. They had the best line of scrimmage in football by a mile. They were the best offensive line. Their defensive line was still a threat with Tuck kind of coming into his own, O.C. Umanyora. Like, that team was, it dominated the line of scrimmage. I remember going, you know, this was right in the same time that Pittsburgh was great with Roethlisberger. They went into Pittsburgh and kicked the crap out of the Steelers. They were on their way to becoming repeat champions. They were dominant. And then the Plaxico Burress thing happens. And we all know what happened, and then, of course, Antonio Pierce gets wrapped into it and everything, and the team never recovered from it. I think you could argue that was as good a team. Now, I know the 0-1 three-time defending world champs, New York Yankees, lost in 0-1. You could argue that team, clearly, that group, but they won so many, it's hard to, like, pick out that 0-1 team and say, yeah, they were great. They were good. Good enough to win a championship. Had the lead in the ninth with Mariano on the mound. But I think you could argue, I'm trying to think of other, the 94 Knicks.
Maybe one of the Rangers teams, the like 98 Jets. Or 20?
Yeah.
Or not 20, but you know what I mean, 22 or 3?
Yeah, maybe one of the Ranger teams. I mean, they won the President's Trophy a couple of years ago, 2 years ago. I don't think we view them the same. I think you could make an argument that that's the best team, at least in my generation. You know, going back to when I started watching sports in the, let's say, early 90s. That's about as good a New York team that didn't win the championship was that 08 Giants team.
I have a quick, and this could be a tough one to answer. It's a projection question.
It's a projection question. Okay.
Yeah, because I don't know anything about these projectors. Teams. Well, we're talking
that's
about
failures,
right?
That's before my time, too.
Hey. Listen, we got failures on the mind, we got to project a little bit here, and hopefully this doesn't come true.
We had a teacher that loved using he would hand out papers and then put it on the projector and would read off the, like he would hand out the papers, we all had a copy, and then he would put it on the projector and go through it. And he would just read off the screen and not pay attention, and we would rip up the projector, write, you know, put dirty things on it, I don't want to tell you.
Oh, anyway. That's great.
Yeah, it was very funny. All right, but what do you got?
No, so I was going to say, we're talking about teams, best team who has failed, right?
Yeah.
Who didn't win.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to have one at MSG in June next year when we talk about these Knicks, especially since we just brought in Mike Brown today, did the presser?
No.
I mean,
I don't think, I'll tell you why. No, we won't. Because if they're not good enough to get through this Eastern Conference, they're not good enough to be on this list. Now, again, they lost to the Eagles, that 08 team. Was that the year they lost to Jeff Garcia? I got to double check. Was that the year they lost to Jeff Garcia's Eagles, or was that just the year they lost to Donovan McNabb? I can't remember off the top of my head. I should know it because I love that team. I'm trying to think if that was the I don't think it was. I think it was just Donovan McNabb that beat him that year in the playoffs. But they didn't even win a playoff game. So, like, it's they Donovan McNabb. Yeah, I think Jeff Garcia was the prior. Eagles beat the Giants in the playoffs so freaking often it's hard to keep track. Now you're getting me annoyed. I didn't want to be annoyed. I'm trying to be happy. It is a happy day. It is a happy day. I'm a Yankee fan and I'm happy. And I know that's crazy in the middle of all this, and not many of you can understand it. It's a baseball season. I try to enjoy it. Too many of us, right, to the caller's point, too many of us ride the baseball season with this championship or bust, which I agree at the end of the year, we should judge the Yankee season on championship or bust. I don't disagree. I do think there's levels to the bust, but there's only one way to be happy at the end of the season. But they can't win the championship in June or July. They can't. So to hold them to a standard on a nightly basis of something they can't give you no matter how well they play, no matter what they do, they could win every game 10-3. They can't win a championship in June and July. And so to ride it every night and make every single play in every single game and every single time they leave a runner at third base with less than two outs, to use that as some sort of evidence that they're fundamentally flawed and cannot win, like, it's just not a fun way to go about the season. I'm not even saying you're wrong. I think you're wrong. But forget being right or wrong. It's a baseball season. You got to enjoy the highs and, like, it's and try to subsidize the lows. Because what are we doing here? It's about fun. And if you can't enjoy a night where they finally did something with Jazz Chisholm at third base and moved them back to second, it works beautifully. The team coming off a really well-played game, for the most part, against the Mets and turning into arguably the cleanest game they have played in a month and a half. That's as good a brand of baseball and as clean as they have played in forever. They didn't make any mistakes. They took advantage of the other team's mistakes. They played good defense. Other than, you know, Hartlieb being useless and not shouldn't be a part of this team and gives up three runs, including the home run to the home run king at the moment, Cal Raleigh. And giving up three runs. Other than that, that was a well-played, crisp baseball game that I enjoyed thoroughly. And I'm hoping we see more of it over the next couple of days. But I did want to just, for one thing, because I was very critical of the Jazz situation. No doubt. I was absolutely very critical of it. I couldn't understand it. I was screaming about it. But let's just take a second to look at why the Yankees did it, because now you're hearing a bunch of, you know, it went on for a month too long, I don't understand this, you know, and I was critical myself, but let's just think about it logically. And I'm glad they did it. They needed to get off of it. But to kill them completely, like, I understand, once we found out that they literally, like, it wasn't just they prefer DJ LeMahieu at second base, or he's more comfortable at second base, or they're concerned about him making the throw at third base. They literally will not play him. He is physically unable. That's what Aaron Boone said. DJ LeMahieu is physically unable to play third base. Physically unable. So once you hear that, I have to admit, I'm a little more understanding to why they did it and how long it went on. The offense was in the doldrums. They were awful for a month, the offense, or 3 weeks, the offense. Thankfully, even while the last week of losing here, they've started to pick it up. And I think that's probably why he kind of eventually caved. Like, I know Marash was coming up with conspiracy theories about how, and I talked about it last night, that it's going to kill the fans, that he's going to get into the All-Star game at second base before playing second base again for the Yankees. I don't think that's any reason why they did it. I think the offense has picked up and they feel more comfortable having a absolute zero in Peraza. They were going through it offensively, and listen to these numbers from DJ LeMahieu. All right, I'm just trying to be honest. Since June 1st, his last 96 appearances, his last 96 plate appearances, he hit .310 with a .375 on base and a .379 slugging, which is terrible slugging, but overall, that is a over 700 OPS with a 118 WRC plus, which is a stat that pretty much means 100 is an average Major League Baseball player. So he was 18% better than the average Major League hitter since June 1st. 18% better than the average Major League hitter. And since May 24th, he was hitting .344 with runners in scoring position. That is so far away better than Oswald Peraza, who is literally like 340th out of 347 Major League hitters. He is an atrocious offensive player. So while they're going through the slump, and now you know it wasn't a preference of playing DJ LeMahieu at second base over third, he literally cannot play it. So now that we know that and we know what the team was going through offensively and how DJ LeMahieu was actually playing, and I know it's hard to fathom because we watched the games and I'm not telling you I loved what DJ was doing offensively, but for a month, DJ LeMahieu was an above average Major League hitter during a time where the offense was desperate for anything. So I understand now a little bit more why this team refused to just give in to Peraza and not play DJ LeMahieu at third base. He literally cannot physically play it, and they couldn't just afford to ditch an above-average Major League hitter for literally the worst. But now that the offense has picked up, because it's easy to say now, and I agree with it, but it's easy to say now, I'll sacrifice the offense. That's great. Right? They scored 9 runs in Toronto. They scored a bunch of runs over the weekend with the Mets. They scored 10 runs last night. Easy to say, oh, I'll sacrifice the offense. 2 weeks ago, when they couldn't buy a run against the Angels, it's hard to say I'll sacrifice the offense. But we had seen it long enough. It had to happen. But now that we know that DJ LeMahieu literally cannot play the position, I feel a little bit more understanding to what they were doing. But I am glad they changed it because I will sacrifice the offense. Because what we saw was hideous infield defense that killed them on a nightly basis. It just can't happen. You can't have a compromised because of a sore shoulder Jazz Chisholm who isn't making the plays, isn't making the throws, isn't playing nearly close to the level of third base he played last year, and then have a statue of DJ LeMahieu at second base. You can't have it. You could not continue to do it. So not only did you get a nice, comfortable victory from the New York Yankees yesterday, you got some sanity. You got some sanity out of the team, and it felt really good to watch. So hopefully they can move forward with this. And you're seeing positive things start to turn around offensively, right? Wells, 3 home runs in a row. 3 games in a row, 3 home runs. He's opened up his stance a little bit. If you remember, Wells changed the dynamic of the offense last year. He was the cleanup hitter with a 900 OPS in August and September. He changed that. That offense, even with Juan Soto, went through a stretch of being bad for a while. They had J.D. Davis hitting cleanup, if you remember. And they had no one behind Judge. Nobody. until Wells came in and changed the dynamic of the team while Stanton was injured. If they can get last year's second half Wells, that is going to be huge for this team. Huge. And you've got Cody Bellinger with another three hits. And how good has Cody Bellinger been? And we talk about the pivot. He is kind of the face of the pivot, at least offensively, because he's the one player you know for sure would not be here. And to watch him be able to play the defensive caliber that he plays in center field, the great play he made the other day in left field, he's able to spot start at first base if you need him, and he can play all of them extremely well. And now he's hitting the ball. He is a ball player. He saw the bobble in center field, went first to third. This guy is a baseball player. And unfortunately, the New York Yankees over the last handful of years haven't had all that many. That's why we all screamed and clamored that they had to re-sign DJ LeMahieu, because he was a ball player. And there's not, you know, we haven't had too many of them. We've had specialized guys who can hit home runs, but high IQ ball players have been few and far to come by for the New York Yankees, and this guy is absolutely one of them. And just to throw it out there, he was traded for Cody Petit. The next time you feel like yelling about some of the Brian Cashman moves, I'm sure you can. I'm not saying you can't. But just remember, Cody Bellinger for Cody Petit. Now, and $25 million, but it's a pretty good trade. 888-808-1019. McMonagle here with you on The Fan. We'll continue to take your baseball calls. If you want to talk about old things that don't exist anymore, like VCRs or anything like that, I guess that's on the table. As we have a little fun on this Wednesday morning. McMonagle here with you on The Fan. 888-808-1019. Quick break update. Back with more after this.